Thank you for joining us today. Our prayer is that your life will be touched by the Spirit of Almighty God with constant and powerful truths that can be applied to your everyday life.
Got a message for you today, and it's called It's All in the Approach. And I want to kind of set this up before I kind of explain what I mean by that. But we live in a culture, I heard someone call it this the other day, we live in a show-off culture. Have you heard that said before? Even if you've never heard it said, all you got to do is look around and see that we live in a show-off culture. We live in a culture that says, look at me. We live in a culture of fame seekers. We live in a culture of narcissists, really. We live in a culture of people who are always looking for some kind of social distinction, something that separates them from everybody else, makes them unique and significant in a way that that somehow provides some sort of emotional antidote to some sort of thing that they're suffering from. People are looking for significance everywhere. And for the most part, we are chronically preoccupied with ourselves in the culture. Now, I'm not saying that's you. I'm just saying culturally, that's where we're at. People are just obsessed with themselves. And the problem is that they're looking to everybody else to give them significance, to make them feel significant. Andy Warhol is credited with, and he had his own fame, not something to be bragged on, in my opinion, but he is credited with having said that everyone is looking for 15 minutes of fame. Now, just a little FYI, he didn't actually say that, but that's what he was credited with having said. But he said, they say that he said, everyone's looking for 15 minutes of fame. You've probably heard that. And you know, for people who are famous, you know, they've worked really hard to get there, and then I just can't even imagine the work that it takes to maintain it. And it seems like it's a very short period of time before those people who were once household names are people that you're going, you know what, I hadn't even thought of them in forever. You know? Because really, all of that is very fleeting. All of that attention is very short-lived. I want to talk to you about the Kardashians. You guys, I don't even know, is that show still on? I've never seen it, but there's, you know, the Keeping Up with the Kardashians. Do you know what those people were famous for? For being famous. They're nothing. They did nothing. Here's the deal, and some of you might know this, but some might not. The reason that they were able to get that television show was because the dad of the Kardashians was a well-known, high-powered lawyer in Los Angeles. And he rubbed elbows with all the elites in Hollywood and eventually became the lawyer for O.J. Simpson in the trial of the century. He was the lead lawyer. Now, he wasn't necessarily the one you saw all the time on television, but he was O.J. Simpson's main guy. They were friends for years leading up to that, and then he was the lead lawyer in that. And so because of that, his wife at the time, because they divorced later, but his wife, Chris, they divorced, you know, a few years after that, and then she married Bruce Jenner, and we all know that debacle of a story, but she took all of the influence and the connections that she had made being the wife of this Kardashian guy, and she pitches a show to cable TV and says, you know, you need to follow our family around. We are worth watching. And what she did was she found a way to make money off of just being who she was. And she promoted her children, she promoted her family, And she managed to get a television show. And a lot of people don't know this either, but the first couple of years, it wasn't really all that watched. But then a video came out of one of the daughters that drew a lot of attention to Kim, which would be the one probably most of you know recognize the name the most. But Kim did a very X-rated video with her then boyfriend that was plastered all over. It was leaked onto the internet. And so when that happened, then all this attention got stirred up. And then one of the other sisters gets pregnant, and they make the big the mystery of the end of one of their seasons, who's the dad? And so you had to tune in the next season to see who the dad was going to be announced to be. And so it was just kind of crazy. But they went from, I mean, not total obscurity, because the dad was kind of well known, but there wasn't anything any different about them than any of us. But they thought very highly of themselves, and they believed that everybody else should, and they convinced people to do so. Matter of fact, then Kim, you know, she got married, and she's got a couple of kids, and she's married to a real gem of a fella. And her husband, Kanye West, he thinks pretty highly of himself, too. He said once, "My greatest pain in life is that I will never get to see myself perform live." I mean, seriously. He said that. Okay, we're going to switch gears. LeVar Ball. Who knows who LeVar Ball is? Raise your hand up high. Okay. Not about a third of you, maybe. All right. This guy, he's got three sons. Three sons, Lonzo, LiAngelo, and LaMelo. Yes, they are basketball players. Now, LeVar, he's quite a dad. He has spent most of his life trying to figure out, and doing a good job, by the way, trying to figure out how to cash in on his kids. And he's made a lot of money off of them. He played basketball in college. I'm told that he might have played in the NBA, but I couldn't find it anywhere. He averaged the Wikipedia says he averaged 2 points per game in college. But he had three kids, and from the minute they were big enough, they began to be groomed to be NBA players, and one of them is, and the rest of them probably will be, but he thinks quite a lot of himself. He has said some pretty funny things. He said, this is a guy who never played in the NBA, by the way. He said, if the game was played one-on-one, I'd be the champion of the world. Yeah. Interestingly, he's marketing his kids all the time, and he didn't say, my kids would be the champion of the world. He said, I would be. That's kind of weird. All right, he said, when he was talking about Lonzo being drafted by the Lakers, he said, I must be a genius to plan this well. Let's think of pretty highly of yourself. They started a company called Big Baller, where they sell sports clothing and all that kind of stuff. Well, they sell a pair of shoes for $495. And for the people who didn't want to pay $495 for these basketball shoes, he says, if you can't afford the ZO2s, you're not a big baller. Doesn't have anything to do with your ability. It's just if you can't afford them, then you're not a basketball player. On his son Lonzo winning Rookie of the Year, he said, it's already a done deal. I got the trophy already. Just so you know, he didn't get Rookie of the Year. On his son's first year with the Lakers, he said, Lonzo's going to take the Lakers to the playoffs in his first year. He didn't do that either. But here's the one that really, really got me. He was talking about Michael Jordan. And he said, he had the nerve to say, back in my heyday, I would kill Michael Jordan one-on-one. I mean, this is, you can't make this stuff up. He said, there's only two dudes better than me, and I'm both of them. That doesn't even make sense. But we listen to that stuff and we go, oh my, that's ridiculous. That's pride, isn't it? That's arrogance. And we're grateful that we're not like that, aren't we? We're grateful that we're not like that. That's what I want to talk about today. I read a couple of quotes regarding pride and arrogance, and I want to read them to you. The first one says this. It says, confidence smiles, arrogance smirks. And then this one I really liked. It says, arrogance requires advertising. Confidence speaks for itself. You know, I think about LeVar Ball. He's having to do a lot of advertising. And you know what? Right now, it's working for him. I mean, it looks like it's working for him. But pride and arrogance and the search for significance are nothing new. People have been doing this since the beginning of time. Pride, C.S. Lewis said, pride is what made the devil the devil. Before that, he was an angel. But pride made him the devil. So as we talk this morning, I want to ask you to do something. I want you to ask yourself this question: where do I find my significance? I don't want you thinking about someone else that you think deals with pride. I want you asking yourself, where do I find my significance? Because people find it in all kinds of places. Do you find it in your job? Do you find it in your appearance? Lots of people who would never say those words out loud, but everyone around them knows, they find their significance in their appearance. Lots of people find their significance in their bank account. And if it's where, you know, it's at the level that you want it to be, then you're doing well. And if it isn't, then you're not. People find significance in their kids. People find significance in a house, a car, in their clothing. They find significance in friends. You know, that kind of who you know thing. Do you know people that you would call name droppers? People find significance in who they know. People find significance in their accomplishments. You know, there are 50, 60-year-old people still talking about how they won the championship when they were 18 in high school, and they've never picked up a ball or a whatever since that time, but they're still talking about it. They find significance in those accomplishments in life. People find significance in their gender. That's a big one these days because people are, well, I'm insignificant when I'm the gender I was created, so I'm going to become a different gender so I can be significant. People find significance in their spouse. That's a big deal. Some people really take a lot of pride in that. And people, this is the tough one, people find significance in their religion or their spirituality in a way that is not healthy. That's not good. Now, it can be, but we find a lot of people being very much prone to looking at the people around them to determine where they are spiritually. And that's not biblical. That's not what God's called us to do. I want us to go to Esther, the book of Esther, chapter 3. We're gonna kind of just speed through the whole book of Esther from starting in chapter 3. Now, we're not going to read the whole thing. But just to give you a little bit of background, when in chapter 3, Esther's already become the queen, all right? But the king doesn't know at the time that she becomes the queen that she is a Jew. And so she has been keeping that to herself. But some things are getting ready to be set in motion that are going to cause her to have to reveal that. I know that you guys probably know this story. And we're not going to be looking at it for the sake of just looking at Esther. I really want to look at this character, Haman. All right? Because Haman is someone that we might recognize, we might be able to relate to a little bit. In chapter 3, starting in verse 1, it says this. It says, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha. I'm just winging these names here, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded him concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Now remember who Mordecai is. This is Esther's uncle. He's actually her legal guardian because her parents had died. And so he's the one that got her in to the king's house and helped her to become the queen. But he's refusing to bow down to this Haman guy, who's just a guy who is in one of the king's officials. But this guy had been promoted, and so the king had even said everybody needs to bow down to Haman because he's this really super great guy. But Mordecai goes, no, I can't. I'm a Jew. I bow down to God and God alone. So he refuses to bow down. So if you go on down to verse 5, it says, when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. All right, so here's the deal. Haman finds out he's a Jew, and he's like, okay, I'm going to kill all of his people because this really just hacks me off. And what happened ultimately was Haman's significance came into question because It says that everybody who came into contact with him bowed down to him except for one person. Now think about that. I think if every time I walked in a room, all of you except for one of you bowed down to me, I'd be pretty satisfied with that. I don't even know if I'd be able to point out the one that didn't, because I'd be so enthralled and thrilled with all the people bowing down to me, but not Haman. Haman found out there's one guy that's not doing it, and no matter what the other people were doing, he found his complete and total significance or lack of it based in the fact that this one guy wouldn't bow down to him. So then if you go to verse 8, it says, Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, the money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you. So the king doesn't really know anything about these Jews, and he certainly doesn't know that his wife, the queen, is one of them. And so he just hears that, oh, they're not doing what they ought to do. And so he goes, oh, have at it. Just go kill them all. That'll be just fine. And so I want to go then to what happens a little later. Of course, we know that Mordecai goes to Esther and he's like, okay, you gotta save the people. You've got to do something. And he asks her to go to the king, and it's a very dangerous thing that he asks. If you haven't ever seen that Esther movie, you should watch it because it's really good. But he goes, he tells Esther she's going to have to go to the king. He says the really famous line that we still use to this day, and who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. And you could talk on that all day long. But he gets Esther motivated to do something on behalf of the Jewish people that are living in that kingdom. And so Esther goes and presents herself to the king in a way that was quite dangerous for her. She was risking her life when she went to the king because she had not been summoned and asked to go before him. But when she does it, she approaches the king in such a way that we should all take note. She's very humble. She walks in humility, And so because of that, he extends the scepter and she comes forward and touches the scepter. And then he says in chapter 5, verse 3, he says, "Queen Esther, what is your request? It shall be given you even to the half of my kingdom." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I prepared for the king." The king said, "Bring Haman quickly so that we may do as Esther's asked." So they do this. They go and they have this meal. And so then he asks her again at that meal, what can I do for you? And she says, "My wish is that if I've found favor in your sight, I want you and Haman to come tomorrow and to have a meal with me." And so verse 9 in chapter 5 is where I really want to concentrate for just a minute. It says, "And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Then Haman said, "Queen Esther, even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Now, the man just spouted off and spewed for 5 minutes on all the reasons that why he is superior to everyone in the kingdom. I mean, he talks about his wealth. He talks about his advancement, his position, his family. And just gives an overall vision of how incredibly superior he is. And yet he was not satisfied. Why? Because one guy wouldn't bow down to him. Have you ever had those conversations with someone that you're talking to them and they just have to one-up you on everything? I've had a couple of times where I've had a bunch of boys in my car. And I've had to just go, okay, let's stop. Can we please just quit playing this game where we're one-upping the other, okay? What you did was unbelievable. And what you did was equally unbelievable. Because we have this tendency in us, especially, I've raised boys and girls. Especially boys really tend to have that thing where they've got to exert their manhood and show people how great they are. And so you find yourself just in this competition to see who's the best. Well, we all kind of know how this story ends, don't we? First of all, my favorite part, before the ending, which Haman dies at the end, he winds up building a gallows to hang Mordecai on his own property, and then gets hanged himself on that very gallows that he built to hang Mordecai. But my favorite part, though, is this. There's a point at which Mordecai had done something really great before chapter 3, where he had saved the king. There were some people who were wanting to kill the king, and Mordecai had been an informant, and he had told him, hey, these people are going to try and kill the king. And so They caught these guys. They proved that they were trying to do that. And so these guys were hung. And Mordecai was the reason that the king lived. And so later on, the king is reading in his books about all the different things that have happened while he's been the king. And so he reads this about Mordecai. And he's like, I never gave him honor. I need to honor this guy for what he did. So he calls Haman and he goes, what would you do for someone who had done something wonderful for the king? And Haman, he's like, in his mind, he's like, oh, he's talking about me. What do I want him to do? And so he just just spews it all out, all these wonderful things that I think he should get one of the king's robes and then we should take him out and just put him on display in front of everyone and we should shout that he's the greatest. And so he's thinking that's going to happen for him. Well, what happens was he says, that's perfect. That's just what I'm going to do. Go get Mordecai and do all that stuff for him that you just said. So Haman has to like walk in front of the thing shouting how great Haman is. Haman's the best. God does have a sense of humor. You have to admit that that's pretty funny. But in the end, Haman dies because it comes out that he has been attempting to kill the Jews simply because of his own ego and the fact that Mordecai wouldn't bow down to him. All right, so there's a couple of things to consider here. How did Esther approach the king? She approached him in humility and in selflessness, didn't she? When she went before the king, she didn't walk up and say, I'm the queen and this is what you're going to do. That'd have lopped her head off right there if she'd have done that. For one, she wouldn't have gotten what she had set out to get. But Haman, he approached the king really in his heart. That's precisely what he was doing. Oh, I would do all these wonderful things. I'd give him the king's robe. I would do all this stuff. He's doing that because he's going to give it to me. Yes, he's going to give it to me. He approached the king in pride and self-promotion. 100% pride and self-promotion. There's another guy that did that in 2 Chronicles. King Uzziah. He became the king when he was 16 years old. In 2 Chronicles chapter 26, verse 4, it says that he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord according to all that his father Amaziah had done. He set himself to seek God in the days of Zechariah, who instructed him in the fear of God. And as long as he sought the Lord, God made him prosper. He was humble. And he just wanted to please God. But then if you go down to verse 8, it says, the Ammonites paid tribute to Uzziah, and his fame spread even to the border of Egypt, for he became very strong. And then down into verse 15, it says, and his fame spread far, for he was marvelously helped till he was strong. But then verse 16 says, but when he was strong, he grew proud to his destruction. He was unfaithful to the Lord his God and entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. But Azariah the priest went in after him, and they said to him, it is not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord, but for the priests, the sons of Aaron, who are consecrated to burn incense. Go out of the sanctuary, for you have done wrong, and it will bring no honor from the Lord God. And you know what he did? Did he react in humility? Adam gave us a great example of this on Friday in chapel at CMA. It's kind of like finishing your meal after you. But it says that Uzziah was angry. He didn't feel conviction when his sin was pointed out to him. He felt anger and pride. And in verse 21, or no, I'm sorry, verse 19, it says he was angry. It says, now he had a censer in his hand to burn incense, and when he became angry with the priests, leprosy broke out on his forehead in the presence of the priests in the house of the Lord by the altar of incense. And it goes on to say in verse 21 that he was a leper to the day of his death, and being a leper, lived in a separate house, for he was excluded from the house of the Lord. And then in the last verse of that chapter, it says that he was known. You know what he was known for when he died? He wasn't known for being a great king. He was known for having been a leper. Why? Because when he approached God in humility, he was successful. When he approached God in pride, he was leprous and separated from the people of God. Approach matters. How we approach anything, anybody, it matters. It matters whether we approach people or God or money or career or ministry. All of those things, our approach to it matters. When we approach in pride, we're in the flesh. When we approach it in humility, we're in the spirit. And God has a lot to say about pride. He says pride ends in humiliation, but humility brings honor. He said pride leads to conflict, but those who take advice are wise. He says in 1 John chapter 2, he says, "For the world offers only a craving for physical pleasure, a craving for everything we see, and pride in our achievements and possessions. These are not from the Father, but are from this world, and this world is fading away along with everything that people crave." Fame and attention fade away. But you know what? Our significance doesn't. We don't ever stop being who we are. We just get to choose where we're going to be who we are. But we don't ever stop being who we are. But attention will fade. It says, "The Lord detests the proud. They will surely be punished. Pride goes before destruction and haughtiness before a fall. The arrogance of man will be brought low and the pride of men humbled." God says a lot. God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. I don't want God to be against me. Think about that. When it says he opposes the proud, it's saying he's against you. I don't want God to be against me. Pride only breeds quarrels. When pride comes, then comes disgrace. But with humility comes wisdom. He says a lot about pride, and there's way more than I could ever tell you today. But he also says a lot about humility. In Philippians chapter 2, verse 3, he says, "Don't be selfish. Don't try to impress others. Be humble, thinking of others as better than yourselves." Some of the versions say, "Think of others as more important than you." If we just regarded everyone as more important than us all the time, our pride would remain in check. But pride comes because we think we're the most important. It says in verse 8 of that same chapter, "He humbled himself in obedience to God and died a criminal's death on the cross." James 4:7 says, "Humble yourselves before God. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. Humble yourselves before the Lord and he will exalt you." Have you guys ever seen that? There's a video on YouTube of these people and they're being funny. And it's like a worship team, but it's a pseudo worship team in that they're really worshiping themselves. You know, it's really hard to be a music person because, and I've said this many times, my pride has remained, as much as a person can say this, because I don't think anybody can really say this whole completely, but my pride gets put in check often. And here's how it's happened over the years. I'll be just worshiping. We'll be in the middle of worship service, you know, and it's just wonderful. And the moment it used to be this way a lot more, but the moment that I just go, "Oh God, we sound pretty good." You can know that something really bad is fixing to happen. Really, really bad. It has just never failed. But in this video that you can watch on YouTube, it's these people and it's a worship team and they're all gathered and they've rewritten words to popular worship songs. And one of them is that they start singing or they start the playing. And when you realize what they're playing, you're just like, "Oh, I just love that song." And then they start going, "I exalt me." But people do that. We do that. We exalt ourselves, and the Bible says that it's when we humble ourselves that God then exalts us. In Colossians, it tells us to clothe ourselves in humility. That means we get up every single day and put it on. We remind ourselves that God is above all. You know, if we would get up every morning and just worship Him and just declare His greatness and magnify Him and put Him in His place every single day, we wouldn't deal with pride. Every time we would approach anybody, we would be in the right frame of mind. It's really important. C.S. Lewis had a lot to say on pride. My English 4 class, we're reading Mere Christianity, and he had some great things to say on pride. He said, pride is essentially competitive. Pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more of it than the next man. We say that people are proud of being rich or clever or good-looking, but they're not. They're proud of being richer or cleverer or better-looking than others. It's the comparison that makes us proud. The pleasure of being above the rest. And if I would dare say that if we say we haven't dealt with that, we're just really, really not being honest with ourselves. God has the answer for pride. He gives us a way to know and understand our significance outside of what anybody thinks of us. Because we put all of our focus on what He thinks of us. And we put all of our focus on His greatness and His goodness. And when we do that, we're positioned to live and walk in humility. Pride is an exalted sense of who we are in relation to God and other people. Humility is a realistic sense of who we are in relation to God and other people. When we're humble, we're free of pride and arrogance, and that's always the best approach. You know, if you're having problems in a family, ask yourself, what has my approach been? Am I approaching people with this assurance that I am right in whatever we're having an issue with? Because when you go to family members to try and fix something, I don't care how many times you look at them and go, now I'm not saying I do everything right. Oh, you're fooling nobody there. What you're saying is exactly that. When we go to family, when there's a problem, we need to go to them and in humility. Because when we go in pride, even if we think we've got it squashed down where nobody can see it and recognize it, first of all, they can. But second of all, we can't be in love. We can't be operating in the Spirit when we're in pride. And I can say from personal experience many, many, many times, it doesn't work. I've been quite sure many times that if I just really, in a detailed, very civil, low-key manner, explained to the person right in front of me how wrong they were, they would finally get it. But they don't. Why? Because they know, they can sense in me that I'm here to fix you because there's something wrong with you and there's absolutely nothing wrong with me. Pride's a big deal. I want to very quickly go through 7 traits of humble people. Very quickly. We're almost done. Because you know humble people. You know people that you can look at in your life and you go, you might not say, boy, that's a really humble person. But you know what you will say? First thing, that's a really happy person. That person walks in a lot of joy. That's the first thing that you'll notice about people who walk in humility is they're happy, they're content, they're peaceful, they're joyful. The second thing is this, they are others-centered. However, you got to be really careful on this one because I'm going to speak out of experience on this one too, but because I've had times in my life where I've been very other-centered, but it was still all about me. my whole life is for my kids. My kids can tell you this. My kids can vouch that I have said this and not even in the far distant past. My whole life is about you. My whole life is about you. Well, that's not other-centered. It feels like it at the moment, but it isn't. But when we are other-centered, we put others first, not to draw the attention to us that we're so wonderful for having done that, but just to put others first. Just to put others first. The third thing, the third trait of a humble person is this: they can receive correction and criticism. I was talking to Michelle Burns a few days ago, and I don't even remember what we were talking about, but she said something, and I just loved it. There she is. She just said, I am going to be teachable. I'm going to be teachable. And you know what? She and I are exactly the same age, I believe. We're at the point where a lot of people think they know everything. I mean, we've been on this planet for a long enough period of time that we could easily say, you know what? I got this figured out. I want, with my last breath to be teachable and correctable. Humble people are confident. We get this idea that people who are humble are weak, but they're not. They're confident, but their confidence is in the Lord. Their confidence is not placed in themselves. They're confident in God's ability through them, not in their own abilities, but in God's. Humble people are, number five, they're strong. They do hard things. They do really hard things. You know what? They do things like this. They forgive quickly. They are quick to listen and slow to speak. That is hard. Hard. But humble people make that happen. They are slow to get angry. Humble people are approachable people. Number six, humble people are not in the business of self-promotion. They do what God's called them to do, and they believe that God is the one who promotes and advances. And they don't worry about it, and they usually are promoted and advanced. And the last one is this: humble people are thankful. We have to be thankful. And if you find that you haven't been walking in gratitude, then you've probably not been walking in humility. If you find that you're thinking about all the things that you deserve and wish you had and somebody else has and you deserve it more than they do, you're not walking in humility. Humility is out of style these days. There's no question about it. Social media has given a platform to the narcissist, the one who just wants to get on there, point out the faults of other people, and they do it in all sorts of ways. All sorts of ways. My favorite is this. People are so mean. That's one of my favorites. I'm just like, seriously. You're just, okay, you need some attention right now. And you get it, because it's a platform for people to just point out everybody else's faults. But in Philippians 2, it says that Jesus humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death. And Paul said that he died daily. And the fact of the matter is that we should be dying. We should be humbling ourselves to be obedient to the point of death. Every single day. Death to what? Death to ourselves and our need for someone else to provide our significance for us, because Christ is enough. What he did is enough. And I don't need for my kids to make me significant, my husband to make me significant, my associations, my close friends or just people I met one time to make me significant. I don't need what I did in high school to make me significant. I don't need what I did yesterday to make me significant. What I need is Christ. C.S. Lewis also says that if you think you are humble and not proud, it's the sure sign that you are proud. Because none of us think we're proud. And you know what? I'm not saying you're proud in every area of your life. We just all have some place where we could look at ourselves and say, you know what? I got some pride operating there, and I need to get that out. I think every single one of us would have to say that. He says that pride is spiritual cancer. It eats up the very possibility of love, contentment, or even common sense. And you know what? When you listen to those quotes from LeVar Ball, you think that man doesn't have a lick of common sense. On the one hand, and then you go, he's selling shoes for $495. Huh? Maybe. I don't know. But really, I mean, to say that he could take on Michael Jordan. No common sense. But more importantly, it eats up the possibility of us operating in love toward other people. I don't want to go talk to the person that's going to look down their nose at me or try to one-up me with everything that comes out of their mouth. So what I've got to do is I've got to work really hard not to be that person. It says God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. I'm looking for some grace. I'm looking for some grace. And God makes it clear how I can get that. But I've got to be willing to look in the mirror and look really hard. Because it's not fun figuring out where you're prideful. Because nobody wants to admit it. Nobody believes they are. But it is doable. And if you want to walk in the blessing of God, you know, in Isaiah, it says that God, this is the person that I will look upon, is the person who is humble and has a heart of obedience toward me. That's the person that God promotes. And so I want to encourage you today, just throughout the course of this week, whatever you happen to be doing in a day, just ask yourself, God, what's my motivation here? What am I doing this for? Who am I doing this for? And see if we can't do the one thing that I think could really, really turn our country around. Is when people begin to see Christians not being arrogant and proud, but being loving and truthful. It could change the landscape of our communities. I believe that with my whole heart.
We hope that you have been blessed, encouraged, and motivated by today's message. If you are interested in more messages by Christian Ministries Church, then log on to our website at www.cmchurch.net and click on the podcast link.